News. I'm Lori London. As the search for answers as to what happened to a Washington Post journalist who went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and never came out continues, President Trump says it shouldn't impede a U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia. AP correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
The president says whatever happened to the missing journalist Jamal Khashoggi, it's not worth canceling Saudi Arabia's deal to buy American weapons. Khashoggi, a Saudi-born permanent resident of the United States, disappeared after going to the Saudi consulate in Turkey. The Turks say the Saudis killed him there. Trump says he wants answers, but not if they kill the deal.
I don't like the concept of stopping an investment of $110 billion into the United States.
Trump says the Saudis can buy their equipment from Russian or Chinese companies if the U.S. sanctions them. I'm Warren Levinson.
Hurricane Michael's violence was visible Thursday in shattered Florida coastal towns where rows of homes were ripped from foundations and roofs, torn off of schools. Michael made landfall at Mexico Beach Wednesday with 250-kilometer-per-hour winds, pushing a wall of seawater inland. Resident Scott Bootwell says he's grateful to be alive.
Surviving it is the most important thing, I think, is just being able to survive this.
The near record force storm is blamed for 7 deaths. U.S. stocks tumbled for a second straight session Thursday as volatility remained on Wall Street amid worries about higher interest rates and trade wars. The Dow Jones Industrial Average slumped 2.1% or 545 points, bringing its losses for the week to more than 5%. The broad-based S&P 500 also dropped 2.1%. The declines, which brought the major indices to their lowest levels in months, came as President Trump castigated the Federal Reserve. This is VOA. The two-man U.S.-Russian crew of a Soyuz spacecraft en route to the International Space Station survived a dramatic emergency landing in Kazakhstan Thursday when their rocket failed in midair. NASA TV commentator Brandi Dean says the men parachuted to the ground.
They have again now landed about 20 kilometers east of Kazakhstan, and we are now hearing that they're in communication with the rescue forces on their way to the capsule and that they're in good condition.
Rescue crews raced to the scene to retrieve them with reports of paratroopers parachuting to their landing spot. When you invite Kanye West to lunch at the White House, word salad could be on the menu. Warren Levinson has that.
The president's invitation to Kanye West yielded a 20-minute monologue in which the rapper lighted briefly, like a pigeon hopping across a hot pavement in August, on subjects ranging from education to prison reform to the 13th Amendment to industrial policy to violence in Chicago to the ephemeral notion of time to Kanye's suggestion for presidential transportation.
This right here is the I-Plane 1. It's a hydrogen-powered airplane, and this is what our president should be flying in. Look at this jerk.
West wore a red Make America Great Again hat to the meeting, which he said makes him feel like Superman, though he added, since time doesn't actually exist, the again part isn't really necessary. I'm Warren Levinson.
The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has condemned Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen's ongoing civil war, which has killed and injured many children and been responsible for conditions leading to large-scale hunger and malnutrition. Saudi Arabia is one of 6 countries the experts looked at in regard to implementation of the Convention on the Rights of a Child. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva on the committee's concluding observations.
Given the ongoing conflict in Yemen, the 18-member Committee on the Rights of the Child agrees it was always going to be difficult to have a discussion with Saudi Arabia about the kingdom's involvement in the war. The United Nations calls the war in Yemen the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe. The UN reports around 1,300 children have been killed and an equal number injured by Saudi-led coalition airstrikes in Yemen since war started in March 2015.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting. President Donald Trump's lawyers are preparing answers to questions for the U.S. Special Counsel probing Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. According to a source familiar with the matter, the development first reported by CNN. I'm Lori London, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Friday, October 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo endorses PDP presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar.
President Obasanjo is a Nigerian that everybody seeking to govern our nation would love to have his support. And is always courted both by the ruling government and the opposition.
Kola Olubodinya is the spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party. Global Witness says logging companies in Liberia have hijacked a community forestry program intended to empower the local people. Zimbabwe authorities preemptively arrest labor leaders, and South Sudanese and Kenyans protest against South Sudan leaders for looting their country's wealth.
We have been suffered over 50 years, and we need the money to be taken back to the country. Not to be given to the leaders who are there today, they can use it again for the conflict.
Daniel Thao is a South Sudanese civil society leader in Kenya. Health officials are concerned about the sharp rise in the number of Ebola cases and deaths in the DRC. And community leaders hope next month's parliamentary elections in Guinea-Bissau will help the country's neglected healthcare field. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo has endorsed his former Vice President Atiku Abubakar as the presidential candidate for the main opposition People's Democratic Party, the PDP, ahead of next year's general election. The endorsement followed a meeting late Thursday between the two leaders at Obasanjo's home in Abeokuta. Obasanjo says he is willing to work with Atiku to help him reach his goal. Obasanjo endorsed Muhammadu Buhari ahead of the last general election, but then withdrew his support after saying Buhari had failed to address the country's ongoing insecurity and economic challenges. Kola Olubodinya is spokesperson for the People's Democratic Party.
Obasanjo is a Nigerian that everybody seeking to govern our nation would love to have his support, and is always courted both by the ruling government and the opposition. In 2014 to 2015, President Olusegun Obasanjo was behind current President Muhammadu Buhari and granted him both the national and international support. And as such, he's a father figure for many Nigerians, and his views are respected where he stands on any issue also come.
Some are suggesting since this news broke that perhaps the PDP, the main opposition party, should also court the former president to campaign on behalf of the party ahead of the election. Are there any plans afoot like that?
For us in the People's Democratic Party, we will do whatever is needful to get President Olusegun Obasanjo on the side of our candidate and on the side of our party.
Some are saying that because of the perception of Nigerians that the president is incorruptible, it will be very difficult to defeat in the upcoming election. Do you think this endorsement could swing this in favor of the PDP?
Nigerians, as we speak presently, have moved beyond President Muhammadu Buhari and his political party, the All Progressives Congress. President Muhammadu Buhari has failed woefully, virtually on every of his promises to Nigerians in 2015 before he was elected into office. And as such, the economic reality of today's Nigeria, particularly since the inception of the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari, has been so terrible on the side of the people, has been so awful, has been so painful for Nigerians that the moment Atiku Abubakar was elected as the presidential candidate of the People's Democratic Party, there was a reverberation across the length and breadth of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, showing clearly that Nigerians are prepared to vote out President Muhammadu Buhari. Therefore, we need the support of the personality of former President Olusegun Obasanjo to enable us to further actualize the desires of Nigerians.
Kola Olobundinya is the spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Global Witness says logging companies in Liberia have hijacked a community forestry program intended to empower the local people. According to the Liberian law, community forestry is a program that is intended to give communities the right to sustainably manage their own forests by calling the shots when negotiating with logging companies. But in a new report released this week, the anti-corruption group Global Witness said logging companies were undermining the community forestry program. David Young is the Liberia campaign leader for Global Witness. He says some logging companies have been evading the process and making secret deals with local elites.
This report, I think, is kind of a golden opportunity for the new government to turn over a new leaf regarding power to the people in Liberia. But to do so, it will need to right the wrongs of the years past. And what this report is showing is how in recent years companies have approached communities prior to communities having a forest management permit and tried to do deals with those communities so that when the community gets its permit, the logging company can move in quite swiftly.
What do you mean, David, that these logging companies aren't ensuring the benefits and costs are shared as they should be across the groups? I mean, the profit from logging is not being shared with the communities?
What I'm saying is that these deals that are done before they are allowed are secret. So it's difficult to get details about them. The ones that we have been able to get some information about based on our field work and also to their credit based on documents that the Forest Authority have published suggests that the community is obliged to hand its forest over to a logging company as soon as the community itself gets its permit from the government. But it provides no details about any money that the logging company might have used to fund the permit application process, and therefore any kind of indebtedness that the community might find itself in. So there's a line in the report that quotes from an activist working in Liberia, working in the field, that says a company could have been telling a community that it invested $1 million in the permit application process. And so that means once the community has the permit and hands its forest over to a company, the community has to repay the company $1 million, a huge amount of money for a Liberian community.
What would you like for the Liberian government to be doing here?
Well, this is not a problem that's popped up today. It's a problem that has been brewing and in a way has yet to explode because there are over 100 applications for community forests that have not yet been approved. 30 have been approved and there's another 100 or so that have not been approved. If they were all approved, that would be a massive land grab, if you like. And if a community put that land securely in the hands of local communities, that's really good news and unprecedented. But if it actually hands all of that forest, it could amount to more than half of all of Liberia, then that's obviously a disaster for people and indeed for climate change for the planet. So the government needs to cancel any agreements that come to light between a company and community that have been signed prematurely, and they need to sanction those companies so that they are not able to enter into these deals again.
David Young is the Liberia campaign leader for the UK-based Global Witness. You are speaking with me from London. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Friday, October 12th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. A group of civil society organizations in Kenya yesterday joined with South Sudanese refugees living in Kenya to protest the alleged looting of funds by prominent South Sudanese leaders and depositing such funds in Kenyan banks. As Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi, Thursday's protest followed the airing of a three-part documentary showing how South Sudanese politicians are living lavishly while their citizens languish in refugee camps.
Leaders of South Sudan, they are the cause of the war. And when the war is going on in South Sudan, they are doing business.
The Kenyans said the main purpose of the protest was to express solidarity with South Sudanese living in Kenya. They also want the Kenyan government to freeze the assets of certain South Sudanese leaders and to sanction Kenyan banks facilitating the alleged looting of funds. Daniel Dow, a South Sudanese civil society chairperson, says he wants the bank accounts of South Sudanese leaders as well as their assets frozen and taken back to South Sudan.
We have been suffered over 50 years, and this suffered, it has to be taken seriously because the region has been silent for the suffering of South Sudanese people, and we need the money to be freeze, to be taken back to the country, not to be given to the leaders who are there today. They can use it again for the conflict, and we need the money to be used for the benefit of the people of South Sudan.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and his family are among the accused persons who are allegedly living large in Kenya while ordinary South Sudanese are thirsty for peace. Daniel says South Sudanese citizens are suffering in foreign land and that there is need for them to reclaim their country since the leaders have so far failed to bring peace.
All the leaders of South Sudan, they have offices here and they don't even feeling like to build the country. So we need this money to be taken back. We know the name, by name, all the report has been released for the name of these people. But there is no other action which has been taken by the region.
Banks in Kenya have been accused of not raising the alarm whenever an individual has made huge cash deposit more than the required amount. And now the South Sudanese will have to be patient and see if the Kenya Bank Association will abide by its rules. Speaking after receiving the letter from Protesters Association representative Nur Mugambi said they look into the matter captured in the documentary Profiteers of the South Sudan War and give a comprehensive report.
We're the Crisis Action Network and we have received this petition today and we will work to see how to support the review of the policy framework, which includes the Proceeds of Crime and Anti-Money Laundering Act.
Comrade Power!
However, South Sudanese citizens are calling upon the Kenyan government to intervene and save their ailing nation. Kenya and other neighboring countries are hosting thousands of South Sudanese who fled their country due to ongoing civil war that began in 2013. Thursday's protest demanded that the Kenyan government deport former South Sudan Army Chief Paul Malong Awan, who is under a UN travel ban and asset freeze and is said to be living in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Yamorino Jumbo in Nairobi, Kenya.
27 leaders and members of the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions were arrested Thursday while planning to stage a peaceful protest over government proposals to increase the tax on electronic money transfer as well as shortages of basic commodities. They are expected to appear in court today, Friday, to face charges. Police spokesperson, Senior Assistant Commissioner Charity Charamba, was not immediately available for comment, but human rights lawyer Leslie Jamela says the arrests are unlawful because Zimbabwe Constitution grants citizens the right to stage peaceful protests.
We are talking about 12 people in Mashingo. Then in Harare, we have 7 members of the ZCTU, including the leaders, that is the President and the Secretary General, were also arrested in the morning, and they were charged for public disorder. Then in Mutare, we have 20 members of the ZCTU again who were also arrested and charged with the same allegations. On top of that, we also had 26 members and officers of the ZCTU who spent the whole day, handled in the ZCTU offices because officers were just cordoning off the ZCTU offices and they were not allowing anyone to get in and not allowing anyone to get out. All these arrests are in connection with the preparations that the city were making in trying to do a procession or a march and also present a petition with their grievances in terms of what has been happening currently that has resulted in a lot of these economic hardships, including the introduction of the 2% per dollar. So they just wanted to raise their concern, but it appears they were just arrested as a preemptive measure before anything happened.
And we see that the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights is actually representing them. So are there any chances that they'll be released today, Friday?
Like I said, for those that were arrested in Mashingo, they were released late at night with the lawyers being advised that they are going to be summoned to court. So for those that are in Mutare and those that are in Harare, Yes, of course, the Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights is representing them. And we hope that the due process of law is going to take course. And we leave the issue of whether they are going to be released or not in the hands of the court, because the police themselves have not released them.
Why necessarily charge them under this dreaded Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act?
To be honest, I think it's just a matter of just making sure that they were charged, because they'd already taken them in the morning, because they spent the whole day without being charged. Our law is quite clear that you don't arrest someone so that you investigate, but you investigate before you arrest someone.
Leslie Jamela is a Zimbabwean human rights lawyer. He spoke from Harare with Gabe Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. A sharp rise in the number of Ebola cases and deaths has health officials concerned that the situation is at a crossroads. The death toll now stands at 122, with another 194 confirmed or suspected cases. The recent jump in those figures followed an armed attack in Beni, the Center for Aid Efforts. The World Health Organization's Tariq Yasarevic talk with my colleague Paul Alexander about the situation.
We are seeing more cases in North Kivu in recent weeks, and particularly we are seeing cases in the town of Beni. So this really indicates the shift where the epicenter of outbreak is from Mangina to the city of Beni, that basically has seen three quarters of all cases in past weeks. This is something that obviously will make us focus on Beni, trying to reinforce our teams there and try to basically go really deeper in the community. However, the issue is that Beni is seen of insecurity that has increased recently, and this increase in security is probably one of the reasons why we are seeing more cases in town.
So do you think that there's a direct correlation between the period where you guys had to be off the streets?
Well, definitely that could be one of the reasons, probably not the only one. We had been in lockdown for 2 days, that was 23rd and 24th of September, and during those days we were not able to visit any of the contacts who normally are visited every day. But not only those 2 days, there were security incidents after that, and although we continued to operate, every day there would be a couple of hours that certain activities could not take place because of the insecurity, because of the protests in the city, because of shots being heard. So although we still operate, that operations were hampered by the security, and obviously that insecurity altogether is one of the reasons. And not only because of the teams not being able to go out, but also because of the reaction of the population. Obviously, population demands security, and their reaction to Ebola responders is in sort linked to their reaction to the general insecurity, basically thinking that if all these authorities, including international actors, are not able to provide security, how it would be then possible for them to control the outbreak. And we have seen really some of the communities in Beni not really cooperating with the teams. Now, we should see things from the other side as well. Now, the fact that we see more cases could also be a positive sign that the community is reporting more of cases of Ebola.
That was World Health Organization spokesperson Tariq Yasarevic speaking with viewers Paul Alexander. While legislative elections scheduled for next month, community workers in Guinea-Bissau's health care field are hoping long neglected issues might be addressed with the new government. Helena Ariel, head of VIDA, an NGO that focuses on community health initiatives, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the needs they see in the area.
Our biggest project at the moment is a community health project. A way acting with the community is to work with people and to build the projects together with the communities. We have been living in the north of the country in small communities like Susanna for almost 20 years. So our vision of the project is to build the projects according to the needs of the people.
What do you find those needs to be at the moment, and how are you addressing them?
So if the community don't have access to the health, for example, the health center, sometimes it's far away, and there are not so many health centers. And so there is a strategy to improve the access of the people to the health, which is through community health workers, to give better access through the community health workers. And this is to bring some knowledge about health to the people and also some simple treatment of simple cases of diseases to these people.
That was Helena Ariel, head of VIDA, an NGO that focuses on community health initiatives in Guinea-Bissau. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from the capital of Bissau. It's time now for Daybreak Africa's posting. Here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with match day 3 in the 2019 CAF African Cup of Nations qualifying campaign, where Congo picked up their first win with an impressive 3-1 win over Liberia in a Group G fixture on Thursday. The victory is Congo's first in the qualifying series and sees them up to third place with 4 points, level with Zimbabwe and the Democratic Republic of Congo, who play on Saturday, but with an inferior goal difference. Liberia are last in the group with 1 point from 3 games. In Group F, Ethiopia and Kenya settle for a barren draw on Wednesday at the parked Bahia National Stadium. The draw gave Kenya the edge going in the reverse in Nairobi in 3 days. The Harambee Stars lead Group F with 4 points, same as Ethiopia. Elsewhere in Group K, Chipolopolo of Zambia broke their 2019 AFCON qualifier drought on Wednesday at home with a convincing 2-1 home win over Guinea-Bissau at the National Hero Stadium in Lusaka to collect their first Group K win. The victory saw Zambia join Guinea-Bissau on 4 points after 3 games, where Mozambique are also on the same number of points ahead of Saturday's March the 3 home date against bottom-placed Namibia in Maputo. Staying with the African Cup of Nations qualifying games following the FIFA decision to suspend the Sierra Leone Football Federation, CAF has confirmed the cancellation of both matches between Ghana and Sierra Leone billed for the 11th of October in Kumasi, Ghana, and the 14th of October in Freetown, Sierra Leone. Sierra Leone team will not be allowed to participate in the qualification of the Total African Cup of Nations 2019 unless the confirmation that the conditions stipulated in the Bureau of FIFA Council's letter has been fulfilled. Ibrahim Kamara is a spokesman for the Sierra Leonean Football Federation.
We were suspended by FIFA and we're still serving that suspension. And also the fact that, you know, the back-to-back matches we were supposed to have played against Ghana, you know, those matches were cancelled, you know, recently as a result of the suspension. So since then, there has not been an official statement from the government. So in the press conference actually today, was basically meant to communicate to the general public the position of the government.
Later today, it will be Togo versus Ghana. Angola will meet Mauritania, while South Sudan will travel to Gabon. Cape Verde will host Tanzania, while Rwanda will be up against Guinea. On Saturday, 10 matches have been slated to be played, with Nigeria confronting Libya. And finally, in athletics news, Kenyan marathon runner Samuel Kalali has received a 4-year ban for doping after testing positive for the banned blood-boosting hormone erythropoietin. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, October 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.